Okay, everybody, thank you for coming to our annual open forum with Owen Fisheries Leadership. We're really fortunate every year to have some of the fishery director at the federal and regional levels come to join us to have an open forum talking about anything that you may want to talk about. For folks who are on our panel today, first of all, Sam Rupp, who's been here many times before, he's got this sort of recurring role as the acting administrator of fisheries for NOAA. Next to him is John Bullock, the regional director of the Gloucester office, and then our new science center director, John Harp, who just came to the position that he's been in the science center for a long time. I'm going to turn this right over to Sam and the other gentlemen to make some opening remarks as they see fit, and then I'll be walking around with a microphone. And it's as Sam and John Adrian, if you just catch my eye, I'll bring you the mic, and we'll keep it up. Thank you.
All right, thank you. I am Sam Rauch. Normally, I'm the Deputy Director of the National Fisheries Service in Washington, D.C. I oversee the work of all of the regions and some of the headquarters offices. Occasionally, when the political head of the fisheries service is absent, as is the case right now, I will act as the head of the fisheries service. So I am a career employee, but I am right now acting as the head of the fisheries service until the president decides to appoint a political head of the service, which could happen at any time. Hasn't happened yet. We did finally get our Secretary of Commerce, so the cabinet-level position, Secretary Ross, was confirmed on Monday and sworn in on Tuesday, and so he has just started. He's about it in terms of political people at the Commerce Department at the moment. I expect now that he has actually arrived on scene that we will start getting some more political people. We need a head of NOAA, which is the agency above National Fisheries Service, and we need a political head of the Fisheries Service. Neither one of those have been announced. I would expect at some point that that will be announced, but it hasn't happened yet. So I'm here. I have been here in many capacities before. I come here about every other year or so. I have been here as the deputy director. I have been here as the acting director before. It is always a great thrill on my part to be here to hear directly from you all about issues important to Maine and the entire New England area. This is a very important fishing community here up and down the coast. It's important to the country, as I know it's important to the state. That's why we're here, to hear from you. It is, so we look forward to that. We don't really have an agenda. My experience has been, as I'm sure it's John and John's, or at least John's experience. That we don't really need an agenda, that we can just present ourselves and questions will naturally arise. So that's what we intend to do. I do believe that John has some opening statements. First, I want to turn to John Hare. He is our new director, new permanent director of the Northeast Fisheries Science Center, took over for Bill Clark late last year. We're excited to have him on board. He is a longtime Northeast Fisheries Science person from the Narragansett Lab. Maybe, John, you want to introduce yourself and talk about some of your priorities and where you came from.
So my name is John Hare. So I'm the new Science Center Director. Even closer.
Even closer.
Does that work? Okay, so I'm the new Science Center Director. As Sam said, I spent about 12 years at the Narragansett Lab before moving to Woods Hole. We're in the process of moving to Woods Hole now. And before that, I was down in the Beaufort Lab, Beaufort, North Carolina, for about 10 years. And I've been with NOAA for probably 18, 20 years. In terms of my priorities for the Science Center, I want the Science Center to do the best science possible. And I want us to do that through collaboration, cooperation, and forming partnerships. I'm a strong believer in the participatory management systems that we have with the regional fisheries management councils, and I want to match that with participatory science and research. So I'm very happy to be here at the Maine Fishermen's Forum, get a chance to meet a lot of people, talk with a lot of people about interactions, collaboration, and then listen a lot and learn about the issues which are important to you, and think about those and take those back to the Science Center and, again, really try to do the best science possible. So thank you.
All right. You know John Bullard, but John, you have a few words?
Hello, everyone. My name is John Bullard. I'm the regional administrator at GARFO, Greater Atlantic Regional Fishery Office. It's always good to be at the forum. I think I've been coming for about 25 years. I think this may be the first one where there isn't a blizzard, knock on wood, yet. I do want to introduce a couple of people also here from GARFO, Sarah Heil. Sarah is our groundfish team lead. You may have heard from her a session or two ago. Travis Ford, in the back, blue shirt, works in the scallop team. And Pam Thames, our port agent in Portland. Pam, okay, there. Have I missed anyone from GARFO? All right. My boss is here, too, so if you address me, please cut out any of the four-letter words. I'd appreciate that.
I'm leaving in four.
Okay, afterwards. I noticed Jerry Cushman, the restraining order still hasn't come, Jerry. All right. It'll be here, so watch yourself. All right. I really do enjoy being here. It is a chance to see friends and to listen to people's concerns at various volumes. So what have we heard? And I want to repeat a little bit what we've heard, just so that you can see, have we been listening? And also maybe to provoke a little bit of continuing discussion in the time we have. I guess the session goes till 5 or tonight or tomorrow morning. I wasn't sure.
4:30.
I think recently in this room we heard a little bit of the conflict between the day boat scallopers and the limited access about a growing population of scallops in the northern Gulf of Maine. Also in this room, we heard conflict on halibut catch from under state permits and the implications for federal groundfish permit holders. Third, we've heard about potential conflict between the lobster industry and an amendment now underway by the New England Council to protect deep-sea corals. Fourth, there's always been questions on the monitoring in groundfish, what we're doing now, to cover the cost of ASCII monitoring, what we're going to do next year, what's going on with electronic monitoring, what's going on with the Council Amendment 23. There was the first of six scoping hearings this morning, also in this room. So in all of these issues, it's critical to remember the genius of the Magnuson-Stevens Act, now more than 40 years old, where under the leadership of Senator Warren Magnuson and others, my congressman at the time, Gary Studs, unlike other natural resource protection laws, decisions on how to protect natural resources are made locally. Decisions are made by stakeholders that you know, and many of them on the New England Council are here in this room, and they've been around here. The Executive Director Tom Neese right here in the front row. You know, they're accessible to you. Terry Alexander right here. Terry Stockwell has been around here. You know them. You can get at them. You can give them your opinions. They take into consideration regional differences. They take into consideration that different species can be managed differently in the same region. The same species can be managed differently in different regions. The different deer types can be managed differently in the same species in the same region. And all of that complexity that's inherent in the biology and fisheries can be undertaken because we have the local experts making those decisions. That's the genius of the Magnuson-Stevens Act. And I say all that because this is a partnership. A lot of people in comments say, well, NIMS this, NIMS that. This is a partnership where the council is the preeminent instigator of regulations. And that's the way it should be. We have a role, and it's a significant role, but I'm a firm believer in the partnership set out 40 years ago. And it's paid dividends nationwide, and the statistics bear it out. So I believe in that partnership, and so with that, I think, as Sam said, we'd love to hear what your questions are, your concerns, and we'll try and field them as best we can.
Yeah, let me just say, I do have to leave at 4. This is going to 4:30, so if you want to say anything negative about them, choose your timing well. But we're happy to entertain questions.
Okay, I'll tee off, Sam, if that's all right. A lot of the theme of this local control of fisheries, thinking about the state versus federal control of fisheries, and the most recent example of a conflict between the two is the existing situation with halibut, as we talked about this morning. I wonder if you could give us a little bit of perspective from the D.C. level on these state versus federal fishery management conflicts and how they've been, how they played out historically in other regions.
But let me first start by talking about the importance of the states in the system. Before the federal government started managing fisheries out in federal waters, the states managed them all. The states have much of the data collection program that we rely on. The states interact with the fishermen a lot closer than we're able to, despite the fact that John Zimmerman is and his folks. The states dominate the councils in many instances. The state directors are all on the councils. The fish often don't know the difference between state and federal waters. So the states clearly are our partners, and we do not lightly take conflicts with the states. There are occasions where there's disagreements, either short or long term, between state and federal management. The system clearly favors a lot of patience and deference in trying to work through these issues in partnership with the states. There are some mechanisms which are very cumbersome and unwieldy, in which the federal government can come in and exercise control. We've done that over the course of the Magnuson Act, I think, once or twice in 30 to 40 years. It's very difficult. We in D.C. prefer to work through these issues with the states. The states are 99% of the time excellent partners, and it is much better to work them through in the long run than to try to create a short-term issue. I'm not speaking about anything regarding halibut in particular. I learned a lot when I sat through that session this morning. But you asked about our general view of the federal-state dynamic, and that is our view. We try to work really hard to maintain this partnership as valuable to us.
While we're still on that issue about all of it, you sat through that session. I find it very unfair that a federal permit holder is going to be penalized where a state holder, permit holder, is not. Do you feel like that's fair, Sam?
I know that's something the council's working through.
Let's hope they don't take as long as Joan.
Next up, make sure I'm catching your eye.
Hi, guys. Scott Smith with the Nature Conservancy here in Maine. I have a question for John. John here, the new John, not the more experienced one. So, John, I know you're relatively new on the job, but I imagine you've probably heard once or twice about disconnects between what fishermen are seeing on the water and what we're seeing in the results of our stock assessments. And I know your predecessor had announced some plans to begin to incorporate more industry vessels into the survey to augment what the Bigelow is doing. And the first question I had is if you could just update us on what is happening with that, and also if you have any other ideas on ways that we can help to try to bridge the gap between what fishermen are seeing on the water and what our assessment scientists are seeing through their processes, so we can have a more effective and efficient management system. Thanks.
Great. Thank you for the question. So in terms of working more, the specific question, fishery independent surveys, federal surveys, working more closely with industry, we are committed to working with the Northeast Trawl Advisory Panel, which is a joint advisory panel of Mid-Atlantic Fisheries Management Council and New England Fisheries Management Council. We've been a little bit slow sort of getting that started, and a lot of that was my fault because of the transition from Bill to me. But we're now getting to the place where we can really start working with that group. So my perspective is we're going to work hand-in-hand with the advisory panel and think about and work on improving cooperation from industry in fishery independent surveys. On your second question about ways to bridge the gap, you know, working with the Trawl Advisory Panel is one way, and I think we need to take advantage of similar interactions. I think forums like this are another way. I think it's very useful for me as a federal scientist. I know there's a number of members from the Science Center here to hear about concerns and about issues and think about them from a scientific perspective. So I would encourage people to invite center scientists to forums like this. And, you know, we obviously need for them to be constructive, as this Maine Fisherman's Forum is. I think there's a lot of information that we can learn from participating with the public and with the industry and other stakeholders. So that would be another way that I think we can sort of move toward a more collaborative, more participatory science.
Another one for you, John. Ron Huber with Friends of Penobscot Bay. Now, one of the things we've been following is that NOAA and the New England Fishery Management Council have been developing what's called a habitat area of particular concern for inshore juvenile cod. Might be near shore, one of those two words. And the point of this being that fish that juvenile fish that seek the shoal waters and their prey and so on are things that are most impacted by land-based impacts. As we know, there's all sorts of runoffs and so on. Now, the council has pointed out that that's probably the most significant impact that needs to be dealt with in these shallow waters to manage these fish like juvenile Atlantic cod specifically. And so for this to be meaningful, the scientific communities of these states need to agree on what is a significant potential impact of these sorts of places, whether it's an area that's full of lobster burrows or an eelgrass area, whatever they are. And yet the council says they've got no guidance at all. And the thing is, the council doesn't do pollution, things like that. And so I know that at least back in earlier administrations, the habitat and protected resource folks played a very strong part in protecting inshore waters. And so I know they've got the skills for that. So this new HAPC is really going to be meaningful unless there's some kind of guidance given to them. Is there a way that the Science Center can take a look at that particular alternative that is in the omnibus habitat and help get some guidance for that?
So, you know, your question has several components to it. The omnibus habitat amendment, we have had center scientists reviewing that amendment and providing comments on all the different aspects of it. I can't tell you the answer specifically with that habitat area of protected concern, but I know that we've been looking at all the different elements of that. If you look at the Science Center's science portfolio, we are, and I'm not sure, I don't choose my words as well as my John to the sort of the left-hand side of it. We're relatively weak in terms of our habitat science. We're even weaker in terms of our habitat science inshore. And inshore being, you know, coastal and riverine areas. But I think Maine is the one place where we actually have a lot of capability to really form strong partnerships and focus on the importance of those coastal areas, both as groundfish habitat, but then also as diadem species habitat. The Penobscot River was is one of NOAA's habitat focus areas. The other habitat focus area in the Northeast is the Choptank River in Chesapeake Bay. So hopefully, moving into the future with NOAA Fisheries will be putting more resources into the Penobscot area as a habitat focus area, which will look at sort of the ocean, coastal, estuarine, river component of that whole ecosystem. I think that gets most of your question, but if I didn't answer something, please follow up.
Well, that's pretty... Oh, thank you. Okay. I guess I just actually had a second question. You have a new administration which seems to have a certain amount of unscientific bent to it, the Trump administration towards the EPA and so on. What about NIMS habitat and other environmental protective capacities? Are you going to be able to protect your line people that are out there that are doing reviews?
That might be a better question for Sam.
But
my perspective is that we know what we have to do, and we have resources, so we need to do the best that we can with the resources that we have.
All right.
And let me just say, we do have a new secretary, Secretary Ross. For any of you who perhaps watched either his confirmation hearing or his introductory remarks, he has stressed repeatedly that he values the science that NOAA does. He values evidence-based decision-making. There's been no indication from Secretary Ross or anybody else directed at fisheries that would indicate we should change anything that we have done or should do.
Sure. Okay.
I've got another question for Sam. It's the Magnuson schedule. Is it due to be renewed again?
You talk about the Magnuson Stevens Act. The Magnuson Stevens Act does not technically expire. It doesn't have to be renewed. There is, in the Magnuson Stevens Act, a time limit on appropriations, an authorization of appropriations, which lapsed technically a few years ago. Virtually every statute that exists has a lapsed appropriation provision. So it is right if Congress were to choose to look at it. Congress has normally chosen to look at it about once every 10 years. They are reauthorized in 2007, before that in 1996. So Congress is looking at it. There's nothing significant that happens if they choose not to. The whole process continues on. But there is some issues on the Hill. The bills that were on the Hill in the last Congress, a number of bills, one of them passed the House of Representatives, those, because they didn't get signed into law, are off the table. We have to start again. Representative Young from Alaska did reintroduce his bill, but there's been no action in the House of Representatives or the Senate on that. So if Congress were to look at it, it is right for looking at it, and I expect them to look at it. They're going to sort of start that process all over again. But there's nothing, it's not as if there's a time limit. If they don't get to it, nothing happens.
Okay, there's no significant issues that folks have brought forward that they'd like to see what you do.
Well, there may well be, right? You'll have to ask, there's so much, I don't know whether they're in the crowd, you can ask them about whether they've heard anything. People often go to the Hill. The administration has not brought forth any significant issues, but once again, early in the administration.
Looking for hands. And if there are, oh, here we go.
Thanks, Hank. Hi, Josh Bergman, Environmental Events Fund. I think this question is more for Sam. I'm interested, especially given the new administration has implemented some sweeping executive orders, but also a hiring freeze on federal employees. I'm wondering, first, has there been any implications and ramifications of the hiring freeze in terms of the National Marine Fisheries Service ability to move forward in its work? But also maybe more interesting is some of the new executive orders, especially this two-for-one regulations order, which for fisheries I'm very interested to see how that already impacted your work, and do you expect that that's going to impact your work moving forward?
So let me talk about the hiring freeze first. As one of the president's first actions, he implemented a 90-day hiring freeze on hiring new employees. He's not the first president that's done that. Other presidents have done that. That is to be replaced at some point in the future by a more specific direction from the Office of Personnel Management. So right now, we're operating under that 90-day freeze. We do not know what the situation will be when and if it's replaced. We've had hiring freezes, either officially or not for various reasons. I mean, once our computers went down, so we were in like a month freeze for that. The way hiring freezes go is the longer they go, the more that we are not able to replace positions. It's hard to say that a 90-day freeze is going to be, it will impact certain people in some places, but you can't, the way these are is it depends on who retires or leaves. So we can't say, if there are less federal staff, then there will be less services provided. I can't tell you where or who that, when that will be. It all depends on when people decide to retire or leave. So that's all I can say about that. We'll know more when we know whether OPM, Office of Personnel Management, what they intend to do after the 90 days expires. In terms of the other executive orders on regulations, the President has issued a number of them. The first one was an initial regulatory freeze, which is exactly or very similar to the one that President Bush issued on his first day in office and almost identical to the one that President Obama issued on his first day in office. It did allow a process for regulations to go through. If you work through either your Senate-confirmed head of the agency, which we now have one, Secretary Ross, or work directly with the White House Office of Management and Budget. We've been able to work through all those issues and issue all the fisheries regulations that were needed to be issued on time at the moment. President also issued what's called the two-for-one executive order, which does two things. Basically, it says that we should not increase the economic burden on the populace. So if we're going to impose a new cost, we have to eliminate an existing cost. And also, if we're going to issue new regulation, we have to withdraw 2 more. There were a number of issues that need to be worked out with that order. It is the Office of Management and Budget is the principal agency that implements that order. Their head just came on last week as well. So we are working with them through that right now. At the moment, the guidance from the Office of Management and Budget is it only applies to significant rules. Significance in this term is a term of art that has been around for more than a decade under prior executive orders, which is a rule that has an economic impact of over $100 million or has other salient criteria. Historically, we've had 3 or 4 of those a year. That doesn't mean that in the long run that would be the requirement. It doesn't mean that OMB might not change what is significant. But at the moment, our fishing regulations are able to go through as we work through those issues because they are not significant, and we otherwise work through that process. But as we said with the hiring freeze, I expect more guidance at some point in the future, and we'll have to see what the impact is.
Thanks. Ben Martens with the Maine Coast Fishermen's Association. So Jerry asked a question about halibut, and I just want to kind of take that up a little bit of a level. And in New England, we seem to be having issues where subcomponents of fisheries that have very low levels of accountability or no accountability are taking precedent over others when it comes to the initial allocation process. So basically, state allocations come off the top, recreational allocations come off the top, and what's left goes to those fisheries that are federally managed, that have accountability, tax limits, etc. And so I've heard that this is an issue in other fisheries around the United States as well. And is that something that you guys are starting to look at from a larger picture in terms of how do we make sure that the fisheries that do have monitoring and other requirements on top of it aren't the ones that are going to continue to lose allocation to subcomponents of within fisheries?
All right, I thought it was going to be a helmet question. So we are, we have limited jurisdiction. We have jurisdiction in federal waters. We do not have jurisdiction in state waters. It is quite common around the country, like with halibut, that we take whatever the state water catch off the top. Normally that works out fine because we have long-term relationships with various states, and although there are a couple of occasions where we might enter into a short-term disagreement, in the long run, the programs are aligned. It doesn't do anybody any good to have disparate management regimes. But the way that we operate, since we are the federal government, we technically only have jurisdiction in federal waters, is you have to take the state water allocations off the top. So regardless of whether they're well-managed, not, many states have very well-managed fisheries. And I'm not going to, you know, so that often, sometimes they're better managed than federal fisheries. So that works fine. We do have that issue. Recreational issues, you mentioned that as well. Recreational issues historically have come off the top because in federal waters, at least the recreational component of the catch either was not as significant as the federal component or not seen as significant as the commercial component. I don't know that that is true, and recreational dynamics are changing. In the last decade or so, there have been a lot of strides through the council process to create better management regimes for those recreational fisheries. And I think for at least the charter fisheries, you see many of them are very well managed. It is harder to manage private recreational angling just because it's so diverse and there's not a lot of single points of contact that you can deal with. So in the number of fisheries, those still sort of come off the top. We work through those issues, but that's basically the answer. It is not unique to this area that fisheries come off the top before federal management.
But you're not looking at changing that or how that might need to be adjusted over time?
The federal government is not looking to co-opt state fisheries. As I said, for recreational fisheries, we do look at where this is, where the mortality from recreational fisheries are a significant issue. We look to impose credible management regimes within federal waters. In state waters, we work with states on that issue.
Question for John Bullard. John, as I recall, the service/council was going to embark on what was called a 5-year review of the sector management system. And I think that maybe some activity has started on that, but could you just provide an update of where that process is, what's involved in the process, what, if any, metrics that you know that the service and the council are going to be working at and trying to gauge the effectiveness of this system?
I have my memory refreshed. I think we've discussed it, but I'm not sure it's on the top of our priority list. It may have slipped a little bit, but if someone wants to refresh me on that. Tom, do you want to?
I'm sitting on my hands, John.
Oh, no. There's a microphone right there.
I'll let that start you. John's right. We did talk about doing a 5-year review of the sector management program. We considered starting it, I think, in 2016. And also, then we didn't start it in 2016. We considered doing it this year. Because we're taking on the monitoring amendment, we decided not to begin it this year. Now, down at the Science Center, the Social Sciences branch does have some people who are starting to work on collecting and analyzing some of the data for that review, but we haven't actually, and we maintain contact with them, but we don't actually have a plan for that. I anticipate that, assuming we make progress on the monitoring amendment this year, that we will take that sector review up next year. In relation to the comment about what are the metrics, what are the things you're looking at, I'm not going to be able to recite the whole list. The agency did have some draft catch share policy guidance. I think it's still draft, if I remember right, on the reviews. I think the policy review is still a draft. However, that provided some good guidance on what sort of things you should look at, including how revenues have changed in the fishery, how landings have changed in the fishery. Some of the things that are in there would be nice to look at but can be difficult because of the data is what happened to the participants who didn't receive an allocation in your catch share program and that sort of thing. I expect we'll flesh that out, assuming we start. That'll get fleshed out early next year in 2018.
Thank you. Anybody else have questions? Looks like we're all going to be able to hear from us.
Josh Miller. question, concern, or anything. I think in 2015, NOAA said that it was trying to transition to ecosystem-based management. Just wondering how that was going, how that transition to ecosystem-based management was going.
So the transition is moving. So NOAA Fisheries released the ecosystem-based fisheries management roadmap. I believe it was this summer. And we're working with the New England Council and their ecosystem plan development team to develop a draft fisheries ecosystem plan. Is that fair, Tom?
Yes.
Okay. We've also worked with the Mid-Atlantic Fisheries Management Council, and they've approved the ecosystem approaches to fisheries management guidance document, and they're starting to use that in their decisions at the Mid-Atlantic Council level. So it's moving forward. But you know, it's not going to revolutionize the world next year. But I think it's the approaches and the perspectives are starting to move through the management systems.
Okay, folks. Looks like we're all done here. Going once and twice.
Yeah. It was sale up front. Sold.
I'm Isaac Shookett. I'm a student at Bowdoin College studying marine science, and I'm also a deckhand by summer. So I tend to get a bit of a bigger picture in terms of coming from the science side and the fisherman side. I just want to go back to that allocation question again, because from my personal experience, I see underreported landings on these recreational headboats, and I'm also seeing a higher mortality rate of throwbacks than are reported. And it really worries me that, for instance, I'm from New York, they're talking about increasing the bag limit on striped bass, which is a regional fisheries. And I'm just wondering, I know that recreational fishermen have a huge lot down in D.C., and as a recreational fisherman, I do benefit from that, but I'm also aware of implications of that lobby, and I was wondering if you guys consider at all possibly rolling back some of the regulations on the recreational fishing community and making those more stringent and giving commercial guys more of a break, because it seems like in a lot of those fisheries where the recreational guys have really monopolized the system, it's really put a burden on the commercial fishermen.
I think allocation is always a very difficult decision for policymakers to make. And I used to be a politician before I came to NOAA. I was mayor of New Bedford. And my experience in politics is that sometimes when you have politically difficult decisions, the easiest thing to do is to say, oh, yes, we should do that, let's see, next year, or maybe 2 years from now. And so allocation decisions fall into that category. So many allocations are based on history that can be dated, sometimes decades old, and that can present inequities because fish stocks move, and so geographically fish may not be located where they were 10 years ago or 20 years ago, and also who's catching them may change. And the way we survey who's catching them may change. In particular, with recreational fishing, the data on commercial catch is fantastic because commercial fishermen, even with your youth, you know that, is really excellent. But recreational fishermen are very hard to find. And they're all over the place. And the way we survey is evolving. And we've gone from
one system, MERS to another system, MRIP, and the MRIP system has gone from one type of survey to another. So in those evolutions have produced significant changes. And all those changes have implications for things like allocations. So that's a long way. As Jerry points out, I don't do anything other than long way of saying that councils, or in the case of striped bass, the Atlantic States Marine Fishery Commission, looks at changes from geography, changes from the different catch from recreational sectors and commercial sectors, and says, do we want to look at current data and shift allocation, which always means somebody gets happy and somebody gets mad, or do we want to put that off until tomorrow? And usually the answer is tomorrow. Now, there's ways that we can say you can't do that. Every allocation has to be revisited every 5 years or something. So you got to face the music every 5 years, which is something we're trying to do, so that it forces people to look at current data and make a decision based on that every 5 years, so they have to do that. So that's what we're trying to do that. But that doesn't mean necessarily that it goes from recreational to commercial, or the other way around. Does that answer your question?
Anybody else?
Dave Linney, Cape Medic. Thank you for being here and answering our questions. Just really a plug, not a question. I know a few years ago, NIPS was moving to eco-based management where prey predator is all taken into consideration. I know it's difficult to get to. I trust we're still on that track. I think it's extremely important. I know certain species are easier to get there with than others, but I encourage you to keep along those lines. I think it's extremely important. Thank you.
Let me just say that the Mid-Atlantic Council, John gave an excellent answer about moving comprehensively to ecosystem-based management. In the meantime, there are other steps that get taken along the way, such as making sure that climate information, the impact of climate, is included in every fishery management plan. The Mid-Atlantic Council did a forage fish amendment, and what they did, which is a predator-prey kind of amendment, and in doing that amendment, which essentially was precautionary, saying that for forage fish, no one will catch these fish unless someone develops a plan to catch these fish. So these forage fish were not anywhere on anyone's radar screen. A lot of research was done. People looked and said, oh, look, in doing the research, it does look like there's a directed fishery for chub mackerel. So we found that out in the process of doing research. And we copied a plan that had been done in the Pacific and then adapted it for the Mid-Atlantic. And in doing that, we said, well, the Mid-Atlantic isn't the only council with a Xerox machine. Once we do a forage fish amendment, obviously the Mid-Atlantic isn't the only place with forage fish. It's easier for the South Atlantic, for New England, for the Atlantic States Marine Fisheries Commission to look at that forage fish amendment and say, would we want to tackle this issue too? And we modify this for our region, and perhaps with the assistance of a Xerox machine, we might have forage fish protected up and down the seaboard. That's a component of ecosystem. So you can knock off different pieces of ecosystem management while you're at the same time trying to look at it comprehensively.
I got a question for John here in the end. I know some officers in this room are going to freak out that I'm saying this, but trust me, we're fine. I've been law officering for 30 years, and in the last 10 years, I've never seen an abundance of codfish in my traps like I have. And in the last 10 years, the last 3 years, it's even grown even more. I'm not talking 20 or 30 a day, I'm talking over 100 a day. And for whatever particular reason, this time of year, it even increases more. Instead of us catching, we're catching the codfish, how can we get that to help get the stock increased or the allocation of codfish increased? How can I help you figure out how many more cod there is in the ocean? And I think, and I would gladly take observers any day of the week to show how many codfish there is out there.
That's an excellent question, excellent observation, and a very difficult one for me to answer. I think the, and I've been hearing that observation from fishermen, trawl fishermen, gillnet fishermen, now lobstermen. I think one of the issues is, it gets to your point, if you're catching 100 codfish in lobster traps and those aren't being reported, then when they're discarded, the discard mortality, getting back to your point, is, you know, somewhere greater than zero. And those fish aren't showing, those fish are never going to show up in the assessment. And so somehow, collectively, as a group, we need to get a handle on how many codfish are out there to make sure we're accounting of all of the either caught or discarded, and then put that into the assessment. And the issue is, we've talked about this somewhat, is under Magnuson, you know, the overfishing limit is the legal boundary. And so as we go forward trying to reconcile these different perspectives, we just want to be careful of what the legal requirements are. But I'd be happy to talk with you about observer coverage or trying to capture some of the, trying to collect some of the data coming from the lobstermen, and try to think about what the consequences or sort of implications of that would be for the codfish assessment. But your observation is not your observation alone. I've been hearing it a lot, and clearly we need to think about how many cod are out there in the context of our assessment. I don't know if that answered your question. I successfully talked around it.
I just think it can help.
I just think taking observers and calculating how many lobstermen are catching more codfish can help increase the allocation of codfish as a whole. Right now, we know codfish is restricting the ground fishing effort in the ocean today. I mean, it's killing our sector. It's not just killing our sector, it's killing everybody's sector. And I think either the cod, something's changed. The codfish have changed. They're in places I've never caught them before. Historically, my father and grandfather never caught them like I'm catching them. Climate's changing. I believe it. And why would the codfish change with it?
Thank you.
John, didn't we collect some, didn't we put a bunch of observers 2 years ago at the council? They said that they were going to put more observers on lobsters. They haven't done that? You haven't seen any?
I can't answer me. I don't want to put Amy Martin's on the spot, because she's the head of our observer program. So I'm not sure what observer coverage is in the federal lobster fleet.
We had about 600 days in the last year.
Last year we did complete 537 observer sea days in the lobster pot fishery, but it does kind of go up and down depending on the standardized bycatch production methodology analysis and CDA schedule. So next year it could be lower in a couple hundred. And we've done more work recently with working with the states, especially the Maine DMR, with not having our programs overlap so that they can cover the inshore fisheries and we can cover the offshore fisheries that need more coverage. But we're still working with Atlantic states in increasing the value of our data collection.
So then as that information sort of moves through the system, I don't know, the operational assessment will be redone this fall. It's supposed to include data through 2016. So, you know, to the extent that codfish are in the lobster trap fishery, that bycatch information will work its way into the assessment.
But you don't use that as assessment.
Well, it'll be this, I mean, that would show up as cod discards.
As of now, though, they don't use it.
Well, it would depend on where and when the observer coverage went into the lobster fleet. But you know, that's one of the issues that we have, is that the data in assessments is, you know, 1 to 2 years back when the assessment is done, which is then 6 months to a year off of when specifications are set. So there is that science lag, which is inherent in our process, which is another element that we would like to try to work on at the center, is trying to reduce the lag of where the, you know, when the science is being used in the assessment, when the assessment is being used to set specifications. The assessment setting specifications, there's very little lag there, but the science that's used in the assessment can be 6 months to 24 months old.
Carlos Stoll, Buckfish Foundation. John here, and I've talked a bit about sustainable seafood and how to spread that message. Following on that discourse right there, so there's a lag between the science and the effect of, and we were talking about climate change just after the health thing. So is there a better way to incorporate what fishermen see on the water into that model, you know, beyond just the observer? Is there another way to do that? I mean, is there a way to get, you know, because you know, was it a year ago you had a new modeling that would set up groups of different fisheries by their impact, how they're impacted by climate change. Is there a way to weave in fisherman input that's a little more nimble and perhaps a little more reactive, so that we're not always 2 or 3 steps behind?
Yeah, there are excellent methods out there which could be used in this region and are not. The one example that I like to use, which I think is very relevant, is in the North Sea. There's a social scientist survey of fishermen fishing groundfish in the North Sea, and it's a survey basically, you know, what is your perception of the status of the stock? Do you think there are more out there? Where do you think they are? What changes do you think you've seen? And that information is not used in an assessment proper, but it is used in a sort of in the framework to consider assessment results. And I think there's a lot of room for that type of approach to be used in New England and in the Mid-Atlantic. We just need to find people who are willing to help us develop that.
When you say find people willing to help you develop, you're saying fishermen willing to participate or actual programmatic development?
I mean, I think I would say both. I'm sure that there are fishermen who would be willing to participate, but we need sort of the programmatic support and a framework and a place where we can sit down and talk about how we might set something up like that and which fisheries would we like to start that type of pilot in. I think, you know, have those conversations, really think it out before just jumping into, let's do this for New England groundfish, or let's do this for halibut. Let's have that sort of structured discussion beforehand so that we're making knowledgeable decisions about how we will move something like this forward. So programmatic.
Thanks.
So using the science to assess fishery stocks is great. And pretty credible until there's a mistake. And if we're, like there was in the COD assessments, so if we're trying to develop these new scientific surveys and method techniques, are you also considering a safety net or a way of insurance that if for some reason there's a little bit of a mess up in these new developments, you can account for that and not lose credibility amongst the fishing community and the scientific community?
Yeah, I was with you. I was going to agree with you until losing the credibility. And credibility is something which is hard-earned. But on the science side, you know, people make mistakes. And so I think, you know, we need to get to a place where collectively we can work together and recognize that we're going to make mistakes. And so, you know, we're not there on the credibility side. I understand the science center science. There's a lot of skepticism around it. So there's a lot that needs to be done in terms of building the trust and the credibility. And that's why it's sort of, you know, this survey, bringing fishermen's ideas in as sort of a framework, is a great idea. But I think we need to agree all together that it's something that we want to do, we want to trust each other to do, and then move forward from that point rather than just something jumping into something.
Anybody else? And seeing none, I guess we'll close it down then. John, and Sam, I want to thank you not just for coming to this seminar, but to the forum in general and getting boots on the ground and attending these other seminars and talking to people and really getting close to closing this room. It really is helpful. We're thrilled. Thank you very much.